This is episode number 788 of the Secret Identity Podcast, and today in What's New, we're going to talk about Upcoming Cons, the new Power Chords podcast that Matt and I are doing, Atomic Blonde, and Kevin Eastman's new Kickstarter for Drawing Blood. Our comics this week will be Edge of Venomverse number 1, Generations Hulk number 1, and Mech Cadet U number 1. And this week's creator spotlight is Nicholas Giacondino, the creator and artist on Nightfell, which is coming out soon from Outland Entertainment and Ragnarok Publications.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you!
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
You have 20 seconds to comply.
Good, clean, wholesome fun.
And welcome, everybody, to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letendry here, as always, with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
Doing well. We are going to be talking about a show coming up in another 3 weeks as we record this, but had a blast at Plastic City Comic Con.
Yes, we absolutely did. Let's do our recap of Plastic City Comic Con, because as you listen to this, we just went to the show, and much like we talked about last year and have talked about leading up to that show, it's essentially like a high school reunion for us.
Yep.
It is the regathering of all of the creators that we have become very good friends with. Well, many of the creators that we've become very good friends with over the years into one show. Last year, it was in Leominster, and the show was so successful that it moved over to Fitchburg this year into an ice hockey arena.
Oh, that was the best part.
Which was awesome, because we were basically, you know, they put the boards over the ice.
Yep.
And we were... That's where we were.
Yeah, we were sort of in the right face-off circle.
Yes.
And on one of the attacking zones.
You could have dropped a puck and we would have went at it.
Oh, and I had pucks on my table. I was ready to throw them in
the
corner.
You did. You had the Hartford Whalers pucks. But yeah, I mean, Joe Caramagna, Jason May was there. Obviously, our buddy Mitch Halleck, who is the showrunner and originator of Terrificon, which we'll be going to in a couple of weeks as you listen to this. John Cimino was there. We had Kat Cusio was there.
Her sister Emily.
Yep. Andrew Edge was there.
Dennis Budd. I mean, all of our friends were there, which was great. George O'Connor,
Homeless Comics.
And Griffin S. All of our buddies.
The Heber Brothers, HB Comics. Like, pretty much look at the guest list for Plastic City Comic Con, and those are all our pals.
Yes.
Like, it was awesome. And so spent the whole day. I'm glad we are recording on Thursday. Because for the first couple of days, I was losing my voice because we just spend the whole day talking and having fun and hanging out. And it was just an absolute blast. I mean, I am assuming, because the show looked like it was great for everybody, that will probably be the venue again next year. But we'll wait to hear from Keith and Amy about that. But, you know, not seeing Keith and Amy for most of the day meant that good things were happening all around, you know, because they were visiting with everyone and there was people constantly coming in, and it was really, really good. And I like to judge a show by the reaction of both the attendees when I'm talking to them and they're sort of talking about their experience, and then obviously catching up with the creators afterwards and hearing, you know, if people did well for the show or if they made back their table money or whatever it was. And just like last year, positive on both sides.
Everybody was happy. We had a great time when we went out to dinner afterwards. The conversation was just fun. It was laughing. And that's the way it should be. We've done shows where we've gone out to dinner with some of the folks that we've hung out with at the show. And it isn't always so happy. We sometimes spend a little more time talking about some of the negatives. The only negative about the show is that it doesn't happen every weekend, and that we didn't get to spend a ton of time with Keith and Amy.
Right. But again, they are running that show. So,
yes.
They were kept busy all day, but busy in a good way. We did catch up with Keith at the end of the day when people were packing up, and he was very happy. And we saw Amy on the way out too, very happy as well. So super fun show. You know, those one-day shows, I really like those shows. You know what I mean?
They're fun.
It's a fun show to sort of, it's a one-and-done sort of thing. It was great. And now, of course, we look forward to Terrificon, which is coming up August 18th through the 20th at Mohegan Sun. Tons of great guests, tons of great panels. Mitch had walking pneumonia as he was at Plastic City promoting Terrificon. I mean, if you want to see a promoter that is literally 24/7 promoting their show, Mitch never stops promoting Terrificon and never stops getting feedback from people about what they want that show to be and how they and what kind of guests they want to see and stuff like that. And so I think if you are anywhere in the Connecticut, Massachusetts, New England area, you really should go out to Terrificon and see it for yourself, because it is it's continuing to evolve in just into a more amazing show every year.
Yeah, and you know, sad to see Mitch suffering and being as sick as he was, being a pneumonia survivor. I know exactly what that is like to go through, to be in the stages of it as you were there. Like when you talk with Mitch and hang out with him, he's so passionate about everything, smiling all the time and laughing. And when you have pneumonia, rule number one, don't cough. Rule number two, don't laugh. Because when you start laughing, it goes right into fits of coughing. And there was a few times that we were talking. He was at our table. We were talking about some silly things going on. All of a sudden, he started laughing, coughing, and you and I felt horrible about the whole thing. But yeah, it was
– you're going to laugh when you get that group of people together.
It's amazing to see him still out there pushing. And it was – you know, him out there pushing as he was almost dying, not able to breathe. And the other part too – I've had pneumonia during the summer, and that is the worst because the air is humid, the air is thick, and it's even harder to breathe. Mitch was still out there promoting probably as hard as any other promoter would normally, and he was on, you know, dial setting 3, 4, 5, not 20, 30, 40 where he normally is.
Which, if you know Mitch, I mean, 3, 4, 5, not a bad setting.
That's better than almost anybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. So, so, great experience at Plastic City. Looking very forward to Terrificon. Now, after we got back from Terrificon, that following morning, I went out to the very first showing of Atomic Blonde. And for anybody that hasn't been following this situation, our good friend Anthony Johnston, who I co-host the Thrash It Out podcast with, wrote a graphic novel through Oni a few years ago called The Coldest City. That was developed into the movie that just premiered at the theater this weekend, which was Atomic Blonde, and stars Charlize Theron and James McAvoy and John Goodman and a host of other people. And so I went by myself. I just went to the theater first thing on Sunday morning, sat down, and I've been talking with Anthony about it for a while. And obviously, he's been very, you know, involved in screenings and what South by Southwest and San Diego Comic-Con. They were just out there for that and the red carpet premiere and all this kind of stuff. And it's been awesome to watch him be a part of that and enjoy that and get credit for that. And despite the fact that they changed the name to Atomic Blonde, there's some great nods to Coldest City. His name splashes right up on the screen when you when you watch the movie. But this movie seems like, and it's by the guy who's directing Deadpool 2, David Leitch, I think, it's like it was made for me. First of all, it takes place in Berlin in, I believe, 1989, right around the fall of the Berlin Wall. Charlize Theron is a spy. I'm not even going to go into the details of why she gets sent into Berlin or what is going on at the time. I will just say that as someone who grew up during the 80s, I was born in 74. You were born in 52?
Yeah, that's 53? About right. Or 68.
Or 68. But both of us clearly were old enough to very clearly remember the Cold War, very clearly remember the fall of the Berlin Wall. And so this movie, I'm telling you, when you see it, you're going to flip out, is tailor-made for us. Not only aesthetically does it perfectly capture the vibe of that time, but the soundtrack for this movie is I pulled a couple of songs. Let me just pull my notes here. So here are some of the songs that appear on the soundtrack, which is out now. You can get the soundtrack for Atomic Blonde. Cat People by David Bowie.
Very good.
99 Left Balloons. Father Figure by George Michael. De Commissar by After the Fire. Cities in Dust by Susie and the Banshees. Demonstration by Tyler Bates. I Ran from a Flock of Seagulls. Voices Carry from Till Tuesday. London Calling from The Clash. Wow. Like, you will freak out when you see this movie. Obviously, as huge music fans, the soundtrack is important to us. They nailed it. They absolutely nailed the soundtrack, and the way it's used in the movie is just fantastic. You've seen a lot of action in the fight scenes, and I will tell you, the fight scenes are as good as anything that you've seen on film to this point. Just brutal, brutal fight scenes in these movies. But in some ways, I think people might see the trailers and think that that's what the movie is primarily. It's not. This is a spy movie, and it's a good spy movie. And I just love the way that it was adapted. I think that they did the character that Charlize Theron plays, Lorraine. I think they did her justice. I think they did justice to Anthony's story. And I think the movie itself is just fantastic. So I want to say it made, like, as of the 1st of August, like $22.5 million or something like that. It was up against Dunkirk. It was up against some other stuff as well. But it's holding its own. It's getting good reviews. And I think if you're a listener of this show, you're probably going to love that movie. And I loved it. And I will definitely go see it again. I'm trying to convince my wife to go with me as well. Charlize Theron is amazing in this movie. And the physicality of it is stunning. But everything else is awesome, too. It's just got such a great vibe to it. It's such an 80s spy movie.
When you were telling me about the premise, and the first thing you said was, the soundtrack is amazing. And I said to you, does it have 99 Luftballons?
Of course it does.
Simply because that's a Cold War song from an artist named Nina, who was German. And having that right in there just really shows that everybody took a lot of care into this movie. And it shows how like minds all think alike.
Yes, it really is just a freaking awesome movie. Like, I was so excited because you know somebody that's involved with this. You want it to be good. But we also know from having seen a billion different adaptations of graphic novels and of comics and things that they don't always go so well.
It doesn't go the way that you would want it.
Jonah Hex comes to mind. You know what I mean? Like, and you could certainly point at some of the Spider-Man movies and say that as well. So to be able to sit there and watch this movie and be like, man, I can only imagine if it was a character that I had created, watching Charlize Theron bring that character to life on screen in the way that she did. She completely owns this role. I hope that this movie does well enough. Anthony already wrote a sequel to it. I hope that it can continue, because this is a character that you can tell from watching her that she loves to play.
Yeah.
And just awesome.
You're talking about looking at a screen and of a character we created. We basically created Anthony Johnston, though.
Okay.
So we'll take that.
He might argue with that, but sure. We'll,
to the bank.
You know what? I think as we wrap up these last 14 episodes of Secret Identity, maybe we play a little fast and loose with the facts, Matthew.
Let's do it.
Like, this is our last chance to get those pats on the back in. So sure.
From the podcast that created Anthony Johnston.
Yeah, exactly. And speaking of podcasts, Matthew, if you haven't checked out the Power Chords podcast yet, you can go to powerchordspodcast.com. You can go to iTunes. You can go to Spreaker. Check out the first episode. And the second episode, if it's not already up, will be going up soon. And let us know what you think about that show. You can email us at powerchordspodcast@gmail.com. We would really love to hear, for fans of Secret Identity who enjoy hearing Matt and I talk about stuff, what you think about the new show. And as we did with Secret Identity, we have a very good idea of our segments and our format and things like that. But we always want to hear from people about, things that they'd like to hear about on the show. So we're excited about that.
And we, at the show at Plastic City, were sort of talking to a few people about it, because at that time, it's still kind of quiet. And we were talking to a few people, and it was really funny because we told people that, you know, Secret Identity was coming to an end at 800. And then we followed it up with, but if you like Brian and I talking about stuff and you don't really care what it is, then we got the show for you. And it was funny because, my good buddy Cameron and his brother were there, and they were hanging out and chatting with us. And,
yes.
And we were just, having a great time chatting about stuff. And that was one of the things that came up.
Yes. And I think for us, it feels right.
Yeah.
You know, Power Chords feels like it's the right show for us, and it's the right fit for us. And it's cool to have that show sort of lifting off as we kind of bring Secret Identity in for a landing. So please go and check that out. Even if music is not your thing, we would love to hear you hear what your thoughts are on it and check it out. And some people have been reaching out and having things to say about the wrapping up of this show. People have reached out and said, oh, that's really sad to hear, but glad you guys are still, you know, going to be going on together. I may pull some of those things and read them on the show, but we didn't announce this early so that we could hear everybody tell us about how much they enjoy the show and stuff. I love hearing that, but it's not for us to say, oh, people are really going to miss us. You have done us a service by listening to us for almost 800 episodes. We would love to hear about how the show meant something to you or affected you or what you enjoyed most about the show. But we're not asking for that so that we can share it with everybody else. We just want to hear that.
Yeah,
so if, you know.
It isn't the farewell tour. We are not
correct.
Announcing our tour, and then every time we go to a new stadium, we're picking up cowboy boots.
Yeah, and I just don't want people to feel like we're fishing for compliments.
Yeah.
Like, because we're not at
nope.
all. You know, we have heard already from people that we are very close to and have developed close relationships with, and they know that, and they know what it means to us. And so by all means, please share your experiences with us, but don't think that we're asking for you to give us testimonials that we're then going to share on the air as like, oh, Michael Smith is going to miss us so much. Like,
yeah.
we are thankful for the connections we've made with each and every one of you. And so we're going to continue to do this show justice as we move on toward episode number 800. And we're going to just move on with the show. So in addition to the Power Chords podcast and Atomic Blonde and Plastic City, the other bit of news that I had this week is that Kevin Eastman is launching a Kickstarter, Matthew.
Hmm.
Who is Shane Bookman?
I don't know who Shane Bookman is.
Creators Kevin Eastman and David Avalone, with artists Ben Bishop and Troy Little, want to tell you his story, Matthew, with their new comic book series, Drawing Blood. In 1992, Shane Books Bookman and his brother Paul released their scrappy indie creation on the unsuspecting comic book universe, the radically rearranged Ronin Ragdolls.
Hmm.
To their great surprise, everyone went wild for the adventures of three feline katana-wielding mutant cats, and a multi-million-dollar franchise was born. After more than a decade and a half of global success, comics, action figures, movies, and just about anything else you could sell with a ragdoll on it, the creators imploded. Too young and too naive to know how to handle the sudden pressures of wealth and fame, they split up, and the franchise eventually sold. Now, Books is hitting his 40s, and all his money is gone, his artistic inspiration tapped out, and his very life in danger from the loan sharks his crooked business partner failed to tell him about before committing suicide. It's hard enough to recover from a catastrophic encounter with the hit-and-run driver called Early Success without having to worry about killers chasing you all over town. Drawing Blood is a dark comic drama, the story behind the stories, a look inside the twisted life of a professional cartoonist, a roller coaster of showbiz, sex and fame and infamy, controlled substances and uncontrolled artists, genius and goons. This series takes you into the darkest corners of a mad world only talked about in the hotel bars of Comic-Con. Drawing Blood is co-created by Eastman and Avalone with scripts by Avalone. Primary art by Ben Bishop with some sequences by Kevin Eastman and Troy Little, and a radically rearranged Ronin Ragdolls one-shot drawn by Little. Variant covers will be by Kevin Eastman and a constellation of comic book artists. You can go to kevineastmanstudios.com to learn more, or I will put the link in the show notes of this Kickstarter as well. So clearly, seems
yeah.
what we have on our hands here, Matthew, is a fictional but also inspired by the truth retelling of what the real story is behind the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yes, we are following the exact story up until we get to the suicide of one of the creators.
Correct.
And the gun-running crazies yeah. that are looking for him, the loan sharks. Because
right.
if you go up to Northampton, Mass. Every so often, you'll see a gentleman driving around on a Segway. He's not running from the bad guys. He is Peter Laird and just lives up there as happy as punch.
Yes. And so clearly, Kevin Eastman is telling a version of
yes.
his story from the whole Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles saga. So if you are one of those people who was a fan of the Turtles and wanted to know what really happened there, how did that thing – it sounds like this comic, even though it's quote-unquote fictional, is going to have a lot of insight into at least what Eastman's perspective was on that whole scenario.
It's a lot like Dan Parent and Fernando Ruiz's Die Kitty Die, which is the killing of a character – much like Sabrina the Teenage Witch, as the company changes around the style of the character
yep.
that is no longer there, no longer relevant in today's society.
Right.
They wrote a book about it. It completely makes sense. I am actually very excited about this
yes.
one now.
So, well, you'll be clicking on that link that we put in the show notes then, Matthew, because that is where you're going to find out more about that. So there you go. That is the news that we have for this week. But before we get into comics today, let's talk about facial hair, because one of the things that happened at Plastic City Comic Con this past weekend, Matthew, was that I got many comments.
Yes, you did.
On this beautifully luscious beard that I have now, which has been sort of a spinoff of the mountain man kind of thing I had going on through all the winter months. Now that we're into the warmer months, now that we're into the dog days of summer, I am just rocking the super long goatee kind of I don't know. I don't know exactly what you'd call that look, but basically I'm a third of the way to ZZ Top territory is what I like to think about it as.
You are. If you had a suit and tie on,
right,
you would not be able to see the knot.
Right.
That's how far
Thank
it's hanging
you.
Down.
Thank you. That's a great description of
it's
that.
It's looking really good. And I almost said 80stees.com, make it happen. But it isn't 80stees.com.
It is VikingOilsLLC.com, Matthew, because Viking Oils is what keeps the skin under this beautiful beard from getting too dry and really bothering me and forcing me to make a decision about whether or not to shave this off. Because I'm not shaving it off, Matthew, until I'm good and ready.
It's a decision you don't want to make
right.
because your face itches like I always end up doing.
Right.
But I didn't do it this time. I just wanted a change.
Yes.
And now I'm letting it grow back.
I want dry skin to make that decision for me, Matthew.
Nope.
I want my own heart to tell me when it's time to shave. So
cool shirts, too, coming up as well.
VikingOilsLLC.com is where you want to go for that. And, of course, every season they change sort of the scents and the products that they put out. So that will be also happening very soon as well. So that is our sponsor for the show, Matthew. Now let's get into comics. And let us talk about not the event that you're going to be talking about in a minute, because Generations is currently kind of the big thing on Marvel's plate
yes.
in terms of upcoming events. But there's a little event happening in another corner of the Marvel Universe, in a corner of the Spider-Verse, Matthew. It's called Edge of Venomverse. Don't ask me what the heck the grand plan is for this, because I don't know. I just know that I've been reading and enjoying the new Venom series now that Eddie Brock is back in the symbiote, or the symbiote is back in Eddie Brock. But Edge of Venomverse seems to be kind of a evolution of the covers that you've seen over the past several months, where different characters have been getting venomified, you know, where they have the symbiotes and they're doing the variant covers and stuff like that. Well, this seems to be an event where there are, perhaps from different alternate universes, characters that have been bonded with the symbiote that you're going to see coming together for an event. It almost feels like your Spider-Verse event, right?
Yeah.
Where you had different parts of the giant web that were touching different worlds coming in. This one, this Edge of Venomverse number one, which came out, I want to say, probably about a month and a half ago, is involving X-23, who I know is a character that I believe you collected the initial series
yep.
for, right? You were a fan of X-23.
Really enjoyed it.
This one is written by Matthew Rosenberg. The pencils are by Roland Bashi. Roland Bashi and Adam Gorham do the inks on this one. Daniel Brown is the colorist. Clayton Cole is the letterist. And the editor is Charles Beecham. And what you have when you open this book, and the reason it made me think about you, is because I believe you talked about X-23 way back when she first sort of burst onto the scene. This book starts out with essentially her origin story again. So you see her in an elevator, and you see that she's escaped from whatever her containment unit is inside of the place where they are doing experiments, and she is Experiment 23. And so she, of course, has some of Wolverine's healing factor. She has blades in her hands and in her toes. And here she is trying to escape from this facility. So you see her bursting out of the elevator and taking on a whole bunch of these guards. She gets injured fairly badly, and she is trying to find a way to escape. But she ends up sort of going into a room in the facility where she's trying to hide from the guards, because there's dozens and dozens of them that are trying to hunt her down as she's trying to get out of there. And you see that she is in a room that has a particular glass case that says, "Do not open a live specimen." So she's got kind of her hand against the window, and she's got one of her claws out with the other, and she inadvertently scratches the glass to this particular area of the lab. And lo and behold, what starts to slink out of the small little crack that she's made in the glass, but the symbiote. And as the guards burst through the door to take her down, you see that the symbiote has completely bonded with her, and she ends up slaughtering these guards and escaping from the facility. And then it goes to 2 months later, and I believe this is happening in New York, where there are a bunch of homeless kids that are in what looks to be like an old abandoned bus station, or, oh, it's an abandoned bank. And they're kind of hanging out in there, and they run into Laura, and that's where she's living now. And as she's living there, she's now bonded with the symbiote to the point where it's talking to her and it's telling her, "Why don't we just eat these guys? Just eat them. No one's going to miss them. No one's going to know that they're missing." But instead of eating them, she fights the urges of the symbiote and she becomes friends with them. And so you see over the course of most of this issue that she is living in this old abandoned bank, and she is using her newfound symbiote abilities as well as her natural abilities to help them survive. whether it's distracting a guard so that they can take some food off of a pallet that's coming off the back of a truck or whatever. They are trying to survive any way they can, and she's helping them do that. But some of the kids have been involved with what looks to be organized crime in the area, and when the enforcers come looking for money that is owed to them, you see that not only Laura has been affected by the symbiote, but the symbiote has partially bonded with all of the kids now. And so they all are sort of having these sort of enhanced abilities, and as they are eking out an existence and kind of creating a little bit more of a name for themselves, there are men in black that start coming and looking for her. And so as the book goes on, you see that this notoriety has started to put the target on all of them and not just X-23. And eventually the men in black start coming for X-23 and the rest of them. And in order to protect the kids, she needs to take back all the pieces of the symbiote that she had sort of given to them as gifts, because she needs to be at her most powerful. And so what's interesting about the book, though, is as it winds down and there's sort of this final confrontation where she's trying to protect these kids, all of a sudden a portal opens up and she gets dragged out of there, leaving the kids to face their fate with the soldiers and the men in black and all that other kind of stuff. And she wakes up and she's saying, whoever you are, you're going to pay for taking us away from them. And she turns around, and what she sees is almost kind of like a U.S. agent type of character who also seems to be bonded with a symbiote. And he says, time to forget your schoolyard fights. We've got a war to win. And that's how the issue ends. And so that was the first Edge of Venomverse, which came out, I believe, at the end of June. They're up to three now. Four and five come out in August. And then the actual Venomverse event happens in September. So it seems like they're kind of doing a play on the Spider-Verse event, and they're showing you these characters from different realities that are all being pulled into this event. And I'm guessing that each issue of Edge of Venomverse is just going to focus on one character and how they sort of get sucked into the story, which I think is kind of cool. So I didn't know what to expect going into this book. I kind of dig the premise of it. Of course, you don't get to see any more of the world that she was living in because she's now pulled out of it, but it's a good start. So I have issues 2 and 3 at home. I'm going to dive into them as well, but I was pleasantly surprised. I think Venom is on a comeback trail for Marvel, which doesn't surprise me because the Venom movie is in production now. And so you're obviously going to be seeing a lot more of Venom, and Eddie Brock is going to be Venom. So there you go.
Another interesting time in the history of Marvel Comics. Right now, we have the Secret Empire event that's going on that really doesn't seem to be slowing down anytime soon. And now we are at the beginning of Generations. This is sort of the reboot and going back to the glory days of Marvel Comics. It is a lot like when the New 52 was introduced before the Flashpoint events ended. It's a lot like Captain America's number one coming out before Captain America Rebirth ended.
Although this time I think it's a little more intentional than what it was with that past event, because here it almost is like, in some ways, Marvel wants to distance themselves from the publicity that didn't go so well for, you know, the recent Cap event. So if we can just move into Generations as quickly as possible, that seems to be the way they want to go.
So Generations is something that basically they're going to go back to the old classic numbering and the original feel of the comics. Like Hulk will be going back to issue 709 because that would be the classic. That's the entire numbering from the original series, from the three or four different series that have come out since then. And I will tell you, Brian, because you'd probably be a little excited of where they're going to start the new series. But talking about this one, this is an event that I actually really had a lot of anticipation about. I have completely walked away from Marvel except for Captain America, which is pretty much I'm buying it because I bought it since I was 5.
Because you're a Cap guy.
I have to do it. But I've really enjoyed Secret Empire. I love the story that's going on. I love the twists and turns. I am not reading all the crossovers. I am only reading proper and sticking with Captain America. So I was really excited to try to get myself back into the Marvel Universe. And I've been gone an awful long time because Amadeus Cho is the Hulk, which
right,
I think
he's the totally awesome Hulk.
He's the totally awesome Hulk, which I thought I remember and knew. But we start this one out, and you've got Matteo Bufangi is the artist on this one, and a guy named Greg Pak, who may or may not know a thing or two about the Hulk.
Oh, interesting, because he's also going to be in the next book we're talking about.
And he's also a huge Kansas fan, according to Joe Caramagna. So I need to reach out to Greg and do some chatting about that. So we start out with a Hulk, and he's narrating this, saying, I'm Amadeus Cho, I'm the Hulk, I'm the strongest one there is. And he's going, and he lands in the middle of the desert. But that's not where he started. He started somewhere else, and he was in Washington, D.C., and he lands, and he goes, what the heck, sand, debris, ordnance? Because he gets shot in the back of the head with a bullet, and you see the bullet hit his skin and bounce off, and he turns around.
It must be nice to be like, that's annoying, yeah. Right?
And he turns around to see that he wasn't even the target of the bullet. You see a bunch of army dudes in the old school, you know, with the old M16 machine guns, the old army trucks. They're not coming out there with Hummers and all sorts of crazy stuff.
Drones?
No, this almost looks like back in the day, Hulk smash, chasing Hulk around kind of stuff. Hulkbusters. General Ross is the classic old school guy with a big mustache.
Thunderbolt.
Yep. And he is saying, to Hulk? Well, what are we waiting for? Let's get both of them. And you've got both Hulks looking at each other going, what the heck? What the heck? Who are you? So they start trying to fight the army guys. But the David Banner Hulk, he's screaming, going, dude, Banner, Hulk. He goes, let me get you out of here. And that Hulk, when he is raged out, has no mindset of anything other than destroy, where Amadeus apparently has all his faculties.
Right. He's sort of been able to maintain his intelligence and his presence of mind, Hulk does not.
And that is a huge thing with this particular story, because you've got him saying, you know, hey, let's get out of here, Hulk. We'll get out. We'll think about what we need to do. And then all of a sudden you got these robots showing up saying target identified. And Amadeus goes, hey, guess what? Those aren't manned. So feel, before he can even finish the sentence, Hulk has pounded through and destroyed these things. And then Amadeus is kind of like, feel free to use all your strength.
Sure.
Hulk didn't care.
Hulk didn't seem to be too concerned about whether they were manned or not.
No, he did not care. So now Amadeus is trying to explain to him, we need to get out of here. Let's get out of here. We can talk about this. We can figure something out. I've got some news for you. And, you know, all of a sudden the soldiers are getting closer. And the big Hulk gets up, jumps up, lands right in the middle of the battle, starts taking out tanks and people. Amadeus jumps out, grabs him, and punches him so far from the battle. And then he turns around and looks at the soldiers going, okay, you guys, I just bought you time. Get out of here now. So soldiers don't know what to do. They panic. Amadeus jumps over. He lands right where the Hulk landed. And he says, you know, we need to get out of here. So they jump and hop. Which is really cool to see. And it looks like they're in the Arizona desert. But they end up on the beach, El Matador State Beach. And what was cool, if you remember in the old Hulks, he would hop. Like you'd see him bounce and hop.
And is there any difference between like the level of his ability compared to the level of Amadeus Cho's, or is it presented as if they're very similar?
They're very similar, okay. Except for the brain part, except for the, that mindset. So they get there and he's like, okay, big guy, if you want to fight, I'm ready to fight. We can do this here. But I would really, and before he could say really rather just talk about it, Banner Hulk beats him up, smashes him up. They start pounding each other and hitting each other all the way down into the ground. And as Amadeus is narrating this going, I should have expected this not to de-escalate. This guy is the Hulk, and I should have known that this was going to happen. So they start punching each other down. They're almost like into a crevice, and now they're a little bit tired. And Banner Hulk is looking at him saying, Hulk don't want to fight anymore. And he's like, I don't want to either. And then he looks over and he goes, you're just like me. And he notices that Amadeus has wristbands. And he asks him, do those wristbands, because he's telling him, he's like, and he turns into Amadeus. And Banner Hulk is looking going, do the things on your wrist do that? Do they control you? And he says, well, they help me, but they don't control me. And then Banner gets so tired, he ends up turning back into Banner. So now for the next 3 or 4 pages, you have the two of them kind of talking about everything that's been going on in their individual lives up until this point, until a couple of helicopters show up. And then they're like, okay, guess what? We now got to hide. So they start going into some caves. They hide in there. The caves start getting shot at, but they go deeper and deeper and deeper until they come up 1 mile up above the coast. They come up into this little town. They're walking through it. And Amadeus is like, hey, why don't we go somewhere? I'm starving. I know you are too. We'll go into this diner. And he goes, I just need to find a bank machine. And then Banner is saying, look, I can't be seen. People know my face. And he starts rifling through the dumpster to get food. So Amadeus is realizing and seeing how far down Banner is, that you never think about that side of it, that not only is he giving up his freedom, his humanity, but he's also kind of giving up his dignity. He just will steal clothes off of clotheslines because he needs them. And then you see him eating garbage out of the dumpster. And they're talking about, he's like, you know, I can control him. I can control the Hulk, and I bet I can help you do it too. And Banner's saying, but the Hulk always finds ways out because my anger can't be contained. If I so much as scratch the surface, I can't stop remembering all the bad things that he's done. He goes into the fact that the anger started when he was being abused by his father, and it became so much. That's why he helped create a bomb. He helped create a bomb to destroy things because he was so angry. And he's saying, yeah, science, my country. Nope, it was all the feel my anger. And he said, see, my anger's lethal. It has to be suppressed at all cost. And they start talking and they're saying, look, you know that I understand that your whole life has been a mess and I can come in and out of it, but I really want to help you. And off in the distance, there's an explosion. And what ended up happening was the soldiers bombing the coast awoken this big humanoid-looking sea monster that is now starting to destroy the town. Soldiers are in there fighting it. The Hulks both turn into Hulks. They both fight this monster. And as they start to take the monster down, and it's a great, great, great fight scene, the two of them end up getting blown pretty far away. And the Hulks are talking, saying, you know, so you think you're great, coming in here, getting Banner all excited, taking, talking like you got it all figured out. I know the truth. So now you've got the Hulk, the Banner Hulk, who's kind of being a little more rational than he normally is, but he's talking very angry. He goes, you got a monster in the trunk, don't you? Somewhere he can come in and he hangs out in the back seat, but right now I'm the monster. And then Amadeus turns back into human and he says, it's not like that at all. I just want to help you. And then kind of Hulk blows him off. And then the army shows up, starts chasing Hulk away. But before you see Hulk, Banner Hulk, jump into action, you have Amadeus narrating it, saying, you know, I'm going to go figure out how to end this before this Hulk ends me. Because the Hulk was basically saying, you're mocking me and I will take care of you. You think you're fun and smart because you can go human and go Hulk, human and Hulk.
You think you're better than me?
You think you're better than me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where this starts, ends. But before he can take him down, it says the end. And you turn the page and it says next, because the Hulk disappears, return to Planet Hulk.
Oh, very nice.
With Incredible Hulk 709. So if Marvel's plan is to get me to read this book and read the following series, they kind of got me.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see if they sort of cherry pick what they think were the most popular events of certain characters. Because clearly, like, Planet Hulk, and we reviewed that whole event.
Yeah.
I was a huge fan of Planet Hulk, is a very popular event in Hulk lore.
Yep.
So it'll be interesting to see like what they pick for each character that is going to be this generational connect between new and old. You know what I mean? So that's cool.
Great, great, great book.
All right. Well, we are going to stick with the creator that you just talked about, Matthew, Mr. Greg Pak, but we're going to go over to Boom Studios and we're going to talk about a brand new series called Mech Cadet U from Boom. Greg Pak is writing it. The illustrations are by Takeshi Miyazawa. The colors are by Triona Farrell. The letters are by Simon Boland. And the editor is Eric Harburn on this one. It's created by Greg Pak and Takeshi Miyazawa. And as we start out the book, we are in Sky Corps Academy in Los Robos, Arizona. And you have a general who is, I'm assuming he's a general, who is there and is talking about the history of mechs and humanity. And he's saying, we don't know where they come from or why they came, but 60 years ago today, the first recorded robo-mech from outer space descended upon an Arizona mountain range and befriended a Boy Scout named Skip Tanaka. Skip and his robo-mech partner saved lives, won hearts, and inspired generations by defending the nation from crisis after crisis, culminating with the resounding defeat of the alien monsters known as the Sharg. Captain Tanaka has been off planet for years, but today we, the Sky Corps, carry on the legacy of the best and brightest citizens the world has ever seen, because every 4 years, another group of giant robots arrives to bond with a brand new crop of cadets. And so what's cool is that in literally a page and a half, they've given you the setup for the whole series. One day out of nowhere, a giant robot came down from the sky. At the time, it found a Boy Scout. The Boy Scout became its pilot. They went on to save the world many times over, including from this alien invasion. Now, other robots come from wherever every 4 years, and we train pilots to be able to work with them. And then the robots choose from the cadet, they choose a cadet to sort of bond with, right? So you have this kid who's in the background as this auditorium's full of cadets, except he's not dressed like any of the cadets, and he's watching. And they're saying, someday, you know, some of those cadets might be you. And then all of a sudden, you see here the kid's name get called Stanford. And he turns around, and you see that he and his mother are the custodians there. And they are cleaning up. And he's been watching this whole presentation. And she's saying, we're working here. Get over here and help work. And as he's talking, one of the cadets in the back, Cadet Sanchez, turns around to him and says, you know, if you're going to disrupt the ceremony, you might as well have the courtesy to do it in English, because he was speaking in Cantonese to his mother. And she throws a juice box on the floor and says, why don't you clean that up? That's what you're here to do. And you hear her name get called, and she goes down to the podium because she's one of the top cadets. And so right off the bat, these two are set against each other. And he's feeling kind of bad about that because she embarrassed him in front of everybody. And later on, he's sitting in the terminal watching the shuttle take off that's going to take the cadets out to the area where they're going to meet with these robots that are scheduled to come down. And he's saying, you know, this whole thing is so stupid. And he's talking to his mom, and his mom is kind of saying, you know, you may not get the chance that these guys get. Everybody gets different chances. This may not be the life for you. It's the whole parent trying to explain to the kid that that thing that they want may not be what they're going to get. And of course, he's upset and he runs away. Well, 2 miles north, there's this big platform where the cadets are being brought in and they're getting ready for the robots to come down. And Cadet Sanchez, you know, she's like top of the class. So she's expecting one of these robots is going to show up. It's going to pick me and I'm going to fulfill my destiny. And she is sort of a take no prisoners kind of person. So all of a sudden, two robots start coming down from the sky. And one of them's green and one of them's red. And each robot has a slightly different design, but they're basically aliens that come down and all the cadets are there. And the robot will find one that it wants to pilot it and will reach out to them. And then they'll go jump in its hand and then he goes. And so, you know, these two robots come down and they pick a couple of cadets and she's not one of them. And she's like, what? Where's my robot? And he's like, don't worry about it. I'm on it, the general says to her. And then you see half a mile away, you see that Stanford is riding his bike, you know, back home. And as he's riding along, he sees like this piece of metal on the ground and he stops and he picks it up and he looks over and a giant robot is crash landed on the ground. And this is a piece from its head. And the robot kind of picks up its head and looks at him. And he sees that right above its eye, there's this missing panel. And he picks it up and he's like, oh, okay, well, here, this belongs to you. And he gives it back to the robot and the robot's kind of scanning him. And the robot can see that in his pocket, he has a doll of one of the mechs. So, cause he's a huge fan of them and stuff like that. And so the robot reaches out its hand to him and he's like, I'm not a candidate. I'm not even a cadet, but you can't pick me. And the robot just holds his hand out and he's like, wait, you did pick me. And so the robot picks him up, and as you might imagine, everybody is immediately saying, you know, what are you doing? You can't do this. And, you know, you've got the sort of drones that come in from the soldiers that are saying, we need you to land immediately and get rid of the boy and all this kind of stuff. And you see that the mech that he has befriended now is kind of a little bit of a misfit. You know, he crash landed. He's not so good at landing in general. He kind of lands on his rear end when he tries to land and stuff like that. But he's bonded to these two. And as the soldiers are trying to pull him away from this mech, who shows up but the very first kid, Skip Tanaka, who is now a grown man, who is back on Earth and shows up and says, what are you guys doing? You can't take this kid away from the mech. The mech chose him and stuff like that. And he introduces himself as Skip Tanaka, who is like the legend, the hero. Mm. And now he's standing up for this kid. And so we cut back to the base of the military. And you see the general sort of saying to Cadet Sanchez, I know you're really upset that you didn't get a robot, but, you know, I'm glad that that didn't happen, because why would you want to be at the whim of some alien robot when you can pilot the first 100% man-made human-controlled robot? And they open up a huge hangar, and she sees a very different-looking mech, and she says, oh, that's much better. And that's the way the first issue ends. And so it's fantastic. The story to me reminds me very much of a Last Starfighter sort of situation, you know, and certainly with a bit of Pacific Rim thrown in as well. There's definitely, I think, early on some Pacific Rim references, but I love the idea that they don't know where these robots come from. They just know that every 4 years they show up and they bond with some more cadets, and that's how it goes. And then they go on to become this sort of interstellar protector and that kind of stuff. And so, of course, this kid, who that's all he ever wanted to do, but seemingly would never get the chance, finds a robot who seems to be a perfect fit for him. And that's sort of how things start. So very, very cool first issue of this series. And I'm definitely going to be checking out more. So Greg Pak getting around.
He is.
Doing stuff for Marvel. And I'm sure he's doing a lot of stuff for Marvel at this point.
Probably
in time.
Probably is now.
It's good to see him still, you know, doing series other places as well. And again, boom. Every time we turn around, boom is putting out another interesting original series. And for a company that kind of made its bread and butter early on with a lot of licensed stuff, and still do with like, you know, Adventure Time and Regular Show,
Planet
they just
the
did
Apes.
A crossover thing, Planet of the Apes, but they put in these original series as well from creators that are just fantastic. So definitely worth checking out Mech Cadet U. Those are our new books for this week, but we have a creator spotlight this week, Matthew, before we wrap up. And our creator spotlight, who I just spoke to last night as we record this on Thursday, is Nicholas Giacondino. He is the creator and the artist on Nightfell, which is a sort of, you'll hear him describe it. He goes into detail about the premise of the series, but this is a book that's coming out through Ragnarok Publications and Outland Entertainment. And there is a Kickstarter, which should be up as we record the show today. I'm going to put a link in the show notes. But the cool thing about this Kickstarter is that for the very lowest tier, which I believe is $1, you can get a digital copy of this book. If you choose to pledge more, the goal is to be able to do a print version of the book as well. But they want to get this book into the hands of people. And I've had a chance to check it out. And Nightfell, for me, is a book that very much speaks to the Tolkien fan in me, the D&D fan in me. It's sort of a fantasy book with a very unique twist on how they handle the concept of death and the undead and zombies and things like that. And Nicholas will go and give you the whole premise for the series. And it was great to talk to him. He lives in Argentina, and we were able to connect last night and just talk for a good 45 minutes outside of this interview about our mutual interests and sort of our influences growing up and all that kind of stuff. And it was fantastic. He's a great guy. He has also done other books for Outland and for Ragnarok as well. And if you go to the Ragnarok Publications website, which I'll put a link to in the show notes, you can see the other projects that he's done too. But he was a fantastic interview. He has a ton of passion for this project and really talked a lot about the collaborative nature of it, which I think people will really dig. So Nicholas Giacondino is the creator spotlight for this week. That is going to do it for this episode of the Secret Identity Podcast. So for Mr. Matthew A. Herring, this is Brian Letenry signing off. Have a great rest of your week. And we'll talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
Alrighty, and this is Brian here with the Creator Spotlight, and I am very lucky to be joined tonight by Nicholas Giacondino. How are you tonight, sir?
Hi, Brian. Great. Doing great.
And our signal is good. You're over in Argentina, and we are balancing time zones as we record tonight, but I'm so glad that you could join me. You are the creator and the artist on Nightfell, which is an upcoming book through Ragnarok Publications and Outland Entertainment. And this is another exciting project from this company for me, because I had just recently been talking about Warlock 5, and now here we are talking about your book, Nightfell. And I had a chance to check it out, the first volume of Nightfell. And as someone who grew up playing Dungeons and Dragons and who is also a big horror fan, like, I feel like your book touches on a few different genres, but with a very interesting twist. So I don't want to spoil it. I would love for you to kind of give people the elevator pitch for Nightfell.
All right. Well, first, I hope that my accent isn't too thick, you know. So I'll make my best effort to be understood. Nightfall is something that's been cooking for a couple of years now, which started as me pitching a story to Jeremy, which is the, you know, the co-founder of Outland Entertainment, which has now merged with Ragnarok. And we knew each other from several art sites. And when he started making more projects, I talked about him about a sort of fantasy world that I had created, being a big fan of Tolkien and Dungeons and Dragons and so forth. But which had an element that was, you know, different, because what I was thinking is that I was always a great big horror fan too, like you mentioned. So I always liked zombies or the undead. But I didn't like the fact that, you know, the genre or the zombie as a creature was becoming more and more, you know, normal, so to speak, in fantasy or
almost
television,
boring, right?
Yeah, because I mean, with the advent of The Walking Dead, the zombie became sort of, you know, this creature that you could actually, you know, kill with just a fork to the head.
You're
so
right.
It didn't, you know, build up too much menace, so to speak. So my take was that. The first thing that I thought was that zombies weren't actually going to be the focus of the book. I mean, the focus of the book was going to be this whole, you know, sprawling narrative about this world. But the zombie was going to play the sort of pivotal part in the fact that they were going to be the good guys in the story. I mean, perhaps exactly not the good guys, but they were going to be normal folks who, after they die, they are subject to a sort of ritual and embalming and so forth, a very complicated thing that's been taking place for thousands of years in this world. And when the time came, they would rise up to defend the living from the creatures that live in the night. Because in this world, if you want, such as in Westeros, there is 90 years of daylight, with the exception of a certain time in the day, which the inhabitants call dim light, which is a sort of dusk.
Almost like a twilight, right?
Right, it's a twilight, but never actually, you know, night. So you kind of have, you know, these people have their biological clocks like us, because in dim light they can, you know, go to sleep and so forth, but it's never actually, you know, pitch dark night. Night comes every 90 years when the suns, because there are several suns in this fantasy world, they set, and that's when trouble starts. I mean, if you're not in a walled city guarded by the corpse guard, which are the dead that rise when the night comes, the dead rise. So you can either have, you know, you can be on the wastelands being ravaged by the creatures that come out at night, or you can be inside one of these cities, the most important of which is Camtay, which is, you know, the one where our story is set in, which has, you know, this pretty powerful corpse guard that will fight against these creatures that are called Berunmen, which apparently their only objective is to, you know, eat everyone they find, be it human or whatever. So pretty nasty creatures overall, which are fought by these valiant people, not necessarily warriors themselves, because, you know, after the main pitch that I brought to Jeremy, we put a team together, including the writer for this particular book, which is Jeremiah Talbert, and he helped me, you know, develop certain ideas that we have, and he brought a couple of ideas of his own. So it was a very collaborative project. And Jeremy also brought some of his ideas. So the world kind of grew from my original vision with this main pitch into something very layered. There's a lot of nuances and a lot of things that make up this world that make it pretty believable in terms of a fantasy setting. It isn't just, you know, okay, these guys are here and this is what's going on, and you have to buy it just from our premise. We took a lot of care and a lot of love because, you know, we really believe in this project and what we were doing, and being fans of a lot of different, you know, archetypes within the genres, we tried to make something that was both original in its vision, but at the same time that had that flavor that we liked from, you know, role-playing and from fantasy books like Lord of the Rings and horror stories, too, of course, with the zombies and, you know, the Lovecraftian creatures that, you know, want to decimate the population and so forth. So it was, you know, it's a really, how to put it? It's a really complex world, but at the same time, something that you can get into. It's not like we're going to be shoving details
right
onto people, but something that you're going to discover as the pages, you know, unfold in the book. So it's really just like the book came together as a sort of collaborative project from a main idea. Reading the project also reflects that, you know, you discover things as you go along, and so everything is more organic. It's not something that you know, you're going to be afraid to start reading because, oh, I won't understand what's going on. Or, no, you can jump in and really get the sense of where this whole thing is going. And you will get glimpses of a larger world or, you know, a larger scale to this world. But at the same time, that won't be distracting. It will sort of, you know, fulfill certain bits and things here. You'll get a sense of a mythology without the mythology being there, you know, for you to have to swallow and understand before enjoying the tale. You know, the tale is pretty simple, if you want, because it's good versus evil, light versus dark. But there are certain deeper themes that are going to be there that I think make it richer and will allow us to go beyond this first tale into other, you know, endeavors, like we're planning maybe to make it into an RPG setting. We're planning on doing more stories set in that world, maybe, you know, before the story, after the story. It's going to be a sort of transmedia project at some point. So, well, of course, I'm very excited, but...
Well, I think you hit on the two things that, as I read it, that immediately grabbed me is I am a kid who grew up playing D&D, and my favorite aspect, and even in my own writing, is world building. And so one of the things that I loved about this story immediately is that you're absolutely right. There is a very rich and complex world with a lot of history that you are introduced to in the first volume of this book, but the story that you've crafted is very intimate. And so you have a story that is very sort of tight and brings you very close to a small group of characters against the backdrop of this world that is very rich and has this history and is going through sort of an identity crisis and a clash of beliefs and things like that. And to
me,
those are kind of the best stories, is where you have, you're able to create a large world and in a complex world, but you're able to tell small stories within it that really resonate with people. And I think you really balance that well in this story with these characters.
Well, that was one of the things that that I loved about the project, and it was something that this is a project that sort of I think reflected the best of how it was built, which is at the same time what makes, in my opinion, people feel closer to the work. If when you are reading it, you get a sense that, you know, the writer enjoyed it, the illustrator enjoyed, you know, coming up with the designs, and, you know, the colorist enjoyed working on the backgrounds and everything else and coloring the characters, you will enjoy the tale all the more. So one of the things that Jeremy, the writer, and myself wanted to work into the tale, and which you picked up perfectly, was the fact that there isn't a single hero in the tale. It's not like you can, you know, pinpoint and say, well, this one is the guy that we're going to be following, and that's it. It's not like, well, it's not, but at the same time, it kind of is. I'm a big fan of Conan, the you know, the sure. original movie with Arnold, and despite the fact that he's the titular character, you get a sense of a group too, and a very RPG group at that. You know, you have the barbarian, you have the thief, you know, the and all the other characters. So what we tried to do here too was to manage that interaction, to have the best heroes are the heroes in group. In my opinion. So it's great that we were able to sort of also show how the book was created, you know, as a group, reflected in the actual writing and drawing of the book, so that you get this sense of an adventure with a group of heroes that each has, you know, its own flaws or its, you know, its skills and so forth. But none of them is going to make it alone.
Right.
They need, you know, the other character to sort of carry on and make the adventure great. You know, it's not just about one character, so that's great. And amongst those characters, it's also the world, you know. Also the world itself becomes a bit of a character too, so that was really great to be able to get across.
Yeah, I think you did a fantastic job with that. And, you know, you sort of hit on all the influences that I love too. RPGs, Lovecraft, Tolkien, like all of that stuff feels like you've paid homage to it, but are not beholden to it, because you are doing something different. And you are, whether it be the belief system that we see right in the beginning of the story and how there's sort of this tradition that is now being questioned by some, whether it is the way that magic functions in the world, whether it is the way that the societies are built in this particular world. Like, you can see where the influences come from, but with each one of those, you've sort of turned it a bit and changed it to make it work in this world.
Right, because one of the things that we didn't do, that I don't usually do in any of my projects, but along with the team, we didn't do, we didn't shy away from our influences, because we didn't want to make, you know, this into a book that you could say, oh, well, you know, it's the most original things to come out of comics in the last 10 years. We sort of wanted to tell our story, and, you know, show the love that we have for all these different aspects of you know, fantasy and RPG and everything that we grew up with. We wanted to sort of, like you said, pay homage to it, and at the same time sort of give it our own vision, which is something I'm a big fan of. Stanley Kubrick.
Uh-huh.
And he once said something that stuck with me. I mean, I don't know if he said it or not. You know, quotes are very are a very tricky thing, especially now on the internet. But he once, on an interview, I think, said something like, there is nothing new being invented, but what we have to strive for as creators is to tell the same old stories that have always interested mankind with our own twist, with our own vision. So, you know, in a way, it's like the way he tackled his, you know, his different movies. He did sci-fi, he did horror, he did, you know, suspense, and his ideas weren't, you know, something that you were completely, you know, blown away by, but his vision was, you know, genius about the guy. I'm not comparing myself to Stanley Kubrick, of course.
No, but when you look at a movie like The Shining, right, and you look at you know, the fact that at its premise, you know,
it's pretty basic.
A man who's,
you know,
struggling with his demons takes his family to a remote location, and his mind starts to get the better of him. Like,
right,
that's not
something groundbreaking that you would say, oh, I never.
The way he shows you that and how he gets you inside the head of that person and the way that he presents to you, you know, his slow descent into madness is
exactly
just at a level of craftsmanship that sets him apart from everybody else. And
exactly.
You know, I look at the Nightfall as, which is the same way, like even in my own horror writing, I think like a DM. So, you know, you're creating your campaign world and you
right.
are populating it with the different races and the different societies and the different, creatures that live there. And then you are sort of with each story creating a mini campaign or an adventure within that that you're then showing to the reader.
Right, because Jeremy, the writer, he is actually doing a campaign now, so he is a DM himself, and I've played RPGs for most of my teenage years and well into my adulthood, so we definitely had that going on between us, because somehow it was some folks may be intimidated by the fact that you have to create a world, but when you're a fan and when you've played Dungeons and Dragons and so forth, it's sort of, you know, it becomes a bit of an obsession.
And it's,
you know,
your favorite,
you want to
part.
Know it.
Like, it's the part that
it's the favorite part. Exactly. It's the thing that even if you know, I have been a DM too and so forth. You sometimes, or most of the time, you create, you know, this whole narrative and the campaign and you dream about, yeah, the characters are going to go here. And maybe the characters, you know,
right.
take a whole different decision, and you end up throwing away, you know, 15 maps and every creature that you created and so forth. But it's still worth it because it lingers.
Right.
I mean, it's there. It lays the groundwork. So whenever those characters, you know, pass through a village, maybe that village that you didn't use at first, is going to be completely detailed, and there's going to be, you know, a tavern, and there's going to be this guy in town who knows this and this guy who knows that. So one of the things that we enjoyed the most was, you know, in the creative process to build this whole world, which in turn made it easier for us to later explore it. You know, once it's created, you can put the focus on any bit that you like, that you feel like telling a story with,
right.
Right. at that moment. In this particular story, we're telling a tale, you know, sort of on the brink of, like you said, of a change in this world, you know? It has been a certain way for many, many, many years, centuries even, and now the people, the society is changing, and it's, you know, starting to think differently. So it's a bit of a step into the future. But the world that we developed has such a rich history that we chose that time. But we can later go back and tell you, you know, how those rituals came about, or we can go into the future
right.
to see where all these people ended up with the decisions they made for their society. So it's an exciting project because of that, and the freedom that Outland gave us, which isn't something that that you find with maybe with many publishers.
Right.
You know, usually you get a bit of a micromanaging, you know, and why are you going to put that character there, and why are you going to, you know, have that tale be that way, and why don't you try this? Jeremy sort of, you know, put the team together, and he gave us, you know, this certain directions, but he never said anything in stone. He never told us, well, this has to happen. The story sort of grew organically, so it became, you know, very enjoyable for us, for me as an artist particularly, because I enjoyed everything that I did. And page work, I mean, it's a 120-page novel, so it can become a bit of a grind.
Sure.
to get through. But with Nightfell, it didn't happen. You know, these characters, as I said in a post about it the other day on my page on DeviantArt, these characters became sort of like family. So it was great to be able to, you know, explore them and their contradictions and their fears and what made them heroic, you know, because on top of this being a group of heroes, they're also flawed in certain ways, and none of them wants to be the hero. It's not like one of them is picking up a sword and saying, okay, I'm going to fight all of these monsters and save the city. It's something that sort of lands on them, and they have to do the best they can with what they have. So that in itself makes them heroic, but they never think of themselves as, you know, the hero type, if you want.
Right, they're very reluctantly sort of brought into that, and
right,
and that's what makes for this, I think, that's what makes for a great origin story for them in sort of their first, you know, real test, so to speak. But also, you know, as you mentioned, you're telling this snapshot of a story in time, and you could go backwards or you could go forward in this world.
Right.
But I really love where you've chosen to start with this story and with this group of characters. Now, you just announced, or Ragnarok just announced that this book is going to be kickstarted. What can you tell us about that campaign so far?
Yes, we announced yesterday that there's going to be a Kickstarter campaign on launching on Monday the 7th, and it's going to be an unusual campaign because since we are so excited about this project and you know Outland believes in it so much, we want as many folks as possible to be able to get their hands on it. So the campaign is going to be very, very, very affordable because the lowest tier is going to get you the book. If you pledge just $1, you're going to get a digital copy of the first volume because the book is going to be divided into two volumes. So you'll be able to read this book just from the, you know, from $1. And then there's going to be, of course, other rewards and there's going to be, you know, the possibility of getting an actual book, which as longtime comic fans, we all need sort of have the book in our hands.
Sure.
With that inky smell.
We like
so
the
forth.
Print copy, especially, especially for us
opening
RPG
up the book and
fans
yes,
who have a million books on their shelves that they don't even play, but they have them so they can go through them whenever they want.
Right, so the Kickstarter is going to have that option too. But the main thing that we want to do with it is to sort of spread the word to get as many folks into this world as possible. Because as I said, we are going to try to make this into a transmedia project. So if you like the world in the near future, you may have the possibility, you know, using it for an RPG campaign and, you know, many other things. So, the idea here is to present this world and sort of make it accessible for folks to jump on it. And hopefully, or at least that's, you know, my dream, stream to maybe even have them add to it, which I think makes for the best stories out there, you know, when people get into it and build themselves.
As people listen to this interview now, they'll be able to go to the show notes of this episode and click on the link to go to the Kickstarter, which should be live now, and they can check out the rewards, but also, as you mentioned, get in on the very bottom tier for a digital copy of the book and get exposed to this world.
Right.
So that's really exciting, and I'll put a link to Ragnarok in the show notes as well for people who want to keep up not only with what you're talking about as you go through this project, but other projects that you're doing as well. Where is the best place for them to find you online?
The main hub where I stay is on DeviantArt. I've been there for over 10 years. So everything I do, I always, you know, update there. So you can follow, but I'll send a link too. So you can find me on DeviantArt. And then there's, of course, a Facebook page and a recent Instagram page that I opened up. But DeviantArt is sort of, you know, the main place where I usually get to talk more about the projects and so forth. So,
well, I will put a link to all of those in the show notes, and people should go and check out all of the things that you've already been posting and saying about this current project, Nightfell, that you're working on. I wish you a ton of luck with the Kickstarter campaign, and I really appreciate you taking time to come on the show and talk about the project and the process, because as a Tolkien fan and an RPG fan and a horror fan, this is a project that really speaks to me. So I really appreciate your time.
Right. Thank you. And thank you, Brian, because this is the first time that I do this. So you were great to talk to. You helped me a lot. And the most important thing is that you gave me this space to be able to talk about this, which isn't something that, you know, in this day and age, you can get to so you know, you can't get so noticed with so many creators around and so many cool projects. Sometimes it's hard to sort of put your own out there, and especially as artists, because we always think, you know, less of ourselves. So it's great to be able to speak to folks about this, and that you so generously donated this time for me to ramble on about Nightfell. So,
well, it is my pleasure. It was my pleasure to talk about this project, because it's a great project and I'm happy to spread the word about it. So we will continue to follow this closely and continue to spread the word about it. And hopefully sometime in the future, we'll connect again and talk about not only Nightfell, but whatever other projects you're working on. So thanks again for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you very much, Brian. And thank everyone for listening.
The greatest superheroes come to the Mohegan Sun August 18th to the 20th. Terrificon, Connecticut's number one Comic-Con, returns. Meet actors from the Game of Thrones, Flash, Guardians of the Galaxy, Stranger Things, and a special tribute to TV's Batman, Adam West, on Saturday night. 300 exhibitors, including top artists from Marvel and DC. See the Batmobile, the Batboat, even the Batcopter. It's Terrificon, Connecticut's terrific Comic-Con, Mohegan Sun, August 18th to the 20th. Tickets at Mohegan Sun Box Office or Ticketmaster.com. See more at Terrificon.com.